Welcome to Best Spam Never, a podcast hosted by me, Boris Smilov.
And me, Devin William Daniels.
On this show, we each pick a song, play it, and then discuss it. The theme for this week is laugh tracks.
Yeah, so we're talking about comedy songs, essentially. I guess, well, that was sort of the idea. And neither of us picked Weird Al in what is a huge upset. But there I think we were both trying to be a little clever. So this week we have No Children by the Mountain Goats and Boys Keep Swinging by David Bowie.
Yeah, so I think the idea was that we don't pick comedy songs as such, but we pick songs that make us laugh. You know, for whatever reason. And you know, once you hear these songs, you'll understand they're neither of them is a comedy song.
Yeah, and I think, and we'll talk about this as we dive into the songs in particular, but I think there's something about the song form that, unless you are Weird Al, who is a unique national treasure, it is very, very difficult to just make a song that's like a joke, right? Mm-hmm. Like a joke in the sense of like a stand-up act or something. Right. So the songs that tend to make me laugh are doing something a little different than that. It's something a little more subtle, maybe is the word. But we'll talk about that when we look at how the songs are working specifically. Mm-hmm. So do we want to start with No Children?
Yeah, so No Children's my pick for this episode. It's the song that made me a fan of the Mountain Goats. A friend of mine was talking about this band, and I'm like, who the hell are they? And he sends me a link to the song on YouTube or whatever. And I'm listening to it, and I'm like laughing hysterically at some of the darkest lyrics I've ever heard in one of the most upbeat, like, pop songs I've ever heard. You know, I mean, for a given value of pop song. And I don't know, it's hard to describe what makes it so funny for me, but I mean, maybe I can delve into it after we listen to it.
Yeah, so I guess we're going to each go off and listen, and the listeners will do the same.
Yep, find a copy.
Yeah, it's not that hard, you know how to do it.
No kidding. All right, well, let's go listen to No Children by the Mountain Goats.
All right.
Go ahead and find a copy of the song to listen to and pause the podcast now. All right, so hopefully you just listened to No Children by the Mountain Goats, and hopefully you found it at least you can understand why I find that song funny.
Everyone is crying right now, Boris. They don't understand.
Right, I know. Especially anybody who actually, like, was married at some point. But like, so the song is about the violent dissolution of a marriage, right?
Yeah.
And the, like, emotional thunderstorm that is a result. And this, like, squandered hope and optimism, you know, resulting in, like, the darkest bleakness you can have. Like, you know, it literally describes their marriage as a tire fire. Like, you know.
Yeah. Although there actually are, you know, like, going along with the lyrics this time, there's some pretty... It gets pretty close to, like, straight humor at various points, right? Sort of the line about shaving, right? I hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of the juxtaposition of this... you know, cutting yourself shaving, a very mundane thing. But then this sort of like exaggerated hope that it never gets better. And then also just kind of the pretty much straight joke of saying, you know, our friends say it's dark and we're pretty sure they're wrong. You know, that's pretty much just a joke there. But in general, what's kind of going on in this song, I think, is... it's sort of the, you know, you either have to laugh or cry thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, where it's...
And I think I'm definitely the laugh type, so for me, mm-hmm. this song is just all about that. It's about taking that, like, dark, humorous view on otherwise, you know, depressing situation.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of taking a... It's taking sort of this, you know, kind of objectified look at what is a very subjective experience, right? Mm. Of your marriage collapsing and this, like, despair you're feeling. It's, mm-hmm. it, but it's describing it in these, you know, kind of removed terms as, like, it's almost like he's not really participating in his marriage's disillusion so much as he's, like, observing himself, you know?
Mm.
And from that, you know, from that kind of removed point, you know, humanity in general becomes kind of a joke and kind of silly. And I think he's kind of saying that's sort of the perspective you have to take to survive something like this.
Well, yeah, I think that's expressed right in the very first verse where he says, I hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. You know, it's so that expresses his view, you know, like, first of all, not only are we not worth saving, but then he follows up, I hope we come up with a failsafe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. And it's like, and even the ones who, like, stuck with us, fuck them too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And I do think the sentiment that he's expressing in that first line is, you know, it's not just an exaggeration. That's a very literal feeling that you have, you know, when you're depressed or something and people keep trying to come to you with fixes, right? Well, why don't you do this? Why don't you do this? You know, try yoga. And you're like, I don't want to do that. I just want to marinate in this darkness, right? And you start to hate the people that are trying to fix you. And, you know, I've definitely experienced that. I think most people have to some degree. And a lot of what you do when you're marinating that darkness, right, is you listen to dark music. You listen to music that's reassuring you that your feelings are not completely individual, that they're not exceptional, right? And in this song, he's filling that void at the same time as he's poking fun at it.
Right, yeah. So this is like the optimally dark song, right? Like, it's as bleak as you can go without, like, being death metal.
Yeah.
Which he's a huge fan
exactly,
of.
Exactly, yeah.
For what it's worth.
And I do think he obviously, you know, John Durnyeau, huge metal fan, doesn't make music that sonically really approaches metal at all. Mm-hmm. Certainly not this song. But there's something about the approach, right, that seems fundamentally influenced by that.
Yeah, I think so. Well, so you were talking earlier about the line about, you know, I hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. And so what he does that's really interesting to me in this song and a lot of his songs is that he often contrasts very mundane things with very, like, romantic and grand things.
Mm, yeah.
So, you know, in that verse, he's comparing, you know, cutting himself, like, shaving in the mirror to, you know, the sun rising, you know, and,
yeah,
like
yeah.
the darkness of night. And that's just, like, this very grand, epic view of, you know, something that is very personal, you know, and... it's almost sort of like, you know, like Byron-esque sort of comparison. You know, he has like images of like rising black smoke and, mm-hmm. you know, and then at the end drowning in what I think is his best lyric in his entire body of work.
Yeah.
And is the line that made me absolutely fall in love with John Darnielle's writing and the Mountain Goats as a band in general. And that's the very last verse where he says, I am drowning, there is no sign of land, you are coming down with me, hand in unlovable hand.
Mm.
Which is just the funniest goddamn thing in the world. Like,
yeah.
to describe someone else like that, and then describe yourself like that at the same time. It just, it's such an efficient line to like show how much the narrator hates everything.
There's also a lot of affection in that line, though, in a weird way. It's like you really would have to love someone to hate them that much.
Right.
You know, or to have loved them. And that's the really, I think, the thing that really comes through in this song, more than just, if it was just like, I hate my ex-wife, to, you know, like, that's pretty boring. But you don't just get the hate. You can see, it's sort of like, it's almost a post-apocalyptic song in a way, right? It's talking about these junkyard fires and stuff. But it's like, what makes that interesting is that you can see the remnants, right, of the, of the previous relationship. They're like, they're kind of popping up in this song like the Statue of Liberty in the desert, right? And you can kind of, he's kind of like Charlton Heston, right? And like you bastards, you blew it up, or whatever he says.
Right.
And I also just love the ending on, I hope you die, I hope we both die.
Yeah, that's I think that is the closest thing you get to a chorus in the song.
But it doesn't keep repeating, which you almost expect it to do.
Right.
Like he repeats it twice, but then it just does this little, and it's this cutesy little piano melody and like strummy acoustic guitars, which has been like, I hope we both die is like, you know, is bringing that in, which is very interesting.
Well, so what I think is brilliant about it is that he says, I hope you die. And the first time he says it, it says, the line goes, in my life, I hope I lie and tell everyone you were a good wife. Which, first of all, is a great line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like it's talking about this golden future in which he can look back on all this and not like be seething with anger. But then he says, "And I hope you die." And for a second, you're thinking, "That's kind of weird. Like, that's a weird thing to say to your wife."
Yeah.
But then he follows it up immediately with, "I hope we both die," and then it's suddenly like crystal clear, oh, that's what's going on.
Yeah.
This is like a larger statement about, you know, the whole situation.
Yeah.
This isn't some petty personal feeling.
And there's that little pause in between the two, right? Where you can almost hear him like thinking like, I hope you die. No, that's not enough, right? That's not really it. That wouldn't solve anything. And the other masterstroke of this song, I think, is the title. Right, which I think, you know, when songs are trying to do work poetically in general, you know, it can be very difficult. And titles can be so useful to get that information across or that premise across or whatever that you just can't force feed into the lyrics. And in this case, it's not so much giving us a premise as it's giving us this extra detail, which it's just like the fact that there are no children as the product of this marriage. When you first hear that, it sounds kind of sad, but, you know, then it's like, oh, thank God. Like,
right.
this is like the one, this is the one positive almost, which is, I guess, why it couldn't go, that detail couldn't make it into the lyrics, right? Because they don't have a place here, but it's almost like you hear this song, you're just like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible for the kids. And it's like, oh no, don't worry. There are no children.
Right. Yeah, I actually hadn't really thought that much about the title before. I mean, the title, the reference of the title is obvious, right? It's the fact that this marriage doesn't have children. But I guess I never thought explicitly about how it impacts, you know, the content of the rest of the song. And it's a very good point in that it kind of makes this break with this couple, which I guess I should say, there's John Darnielle had been writing about this sort of hypothetical unnamed couple for many, many albums running. Mm-hmm. And the album the song is off of, called Tallahassee, is when he decided he was going to like finish with them basically and stop writing about them. And No Children is kind of the like culmination of all of the songs that he'd written about this like terrible, like mutually abusive, dysfunctional, you know, couple of drug using alcoholics, whatever, whoever they were from all the earlier albums. And you know, it's and it's, so in a sense, this song allows the fact, I should say, that they have no children, as the song tells us, means that they can kind of have this clean break.
They can
both like drown, you know, at the end, hand an unlovable hand without anybody else being hurt. And that's kind of what allows their relationship to end.
Or without John having to write more songs, right?
Well, that too.
Like, about the next generation.
Right.
It's kind of, and you can certainly see, you can see the romance and the appeal in that, right? You know, this narrator who he wants everything he knows to end, and then there'll be, there's nothing he's going to miss, right? Because, It's all coming to a close. You can certainly understand that appeal, though it's a very negative understanding that I wouldn't encourage. You know, I think we can feel that. And you know, you compared it to Byron earlier. It actually reminds me a lot of Baudelaire and like the Flowers of Evil, and some of the poems he writes, kind of about, you know, the horrors of modernity and like this new Paris and. It's definitely like the horrors of his love life, but very much like embracing those horrors and kind of, and at various points in enthusiastic verse with exclamation points and everything, casting away positivity, casting, you know, it's like, get that out of here. I want melancholy. I want, you know, death and destruction. And if you, you know, and the song form seems like the perfect place, the perfect media to get that across, where, you know, you get a little more leeway, you know, in the pop music form with being lame, frankly. You don't have to have like the, you know, it seems like kind of comparing it, you know, being funny in a song to being funny in like a stand-up set or something. It would be kind of hard, I think, to sell this bit as straight comedy. But when it's kind of in this pop music form, the different kind of pushes and pulls of the way the music sounds and what the lyrics are saying and what you expect lyrics to be saying in a song like this, they all kind of make it work. Whereas if I just came up and read a poem about my shitty marriage, you know.
Right. So I think there's a lot of songs that, you know, that contrast their subject matter and their musical style. Like one that always stuck out to me, although not as much as this song, is the song "Given It Up" "Given Up" by The Darkness, and it's a super upbeat, poppy rock song. You know, if you ever heard The Darkness, it's just in their usual style, but it's about doing heroin, like it's about doing massive amounts of heroin. And it's super enthusiastic and happy and, you know, and it makes that song incredibly funny. And that one is very deliberately, like, funny, you know, because they're The Darkness, so like novelty, you know, glam band. In a way that the Mountain Goats are not. A novelty band. And so it's this, like, massive contrast. And here I think it works really well because it's even by Mountain Goat standards one of their more upbeat poppy songs. I think it's one of the few singles of theirs that ever gets played.
It's probably his most popular song. That and This Year.
It's almost certainly their most popular song.
Yeah.
Which is probably why it's the first one of theirs I ever heard. But definitely the humor of it is obvious. Like, to almost anybody who listens to the Mountain Goats. For instance, at two of my friends got married, and their first dance was to this song.
Oh, that's pretty good.
And it got an incredible reaction, because, like, half the people didn't listen, you know, and didn't care. And then of the remaining people, half of them were like, oh, this is a nice upbeat song. And the other half were like, wait, what? and with just like so many confused faces around, it was it was exactly the reaction like they were hoping for, and it worked great. Yeah.
And
so.
This is also a great song to see live because you know I've seen it live at least twice, and you know just a room full of 1,000 people singing along about you know I hope we both die is you know there's just something. Like, John Darnielle has to think that's really funny.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Like, I've got all these people shouting about how they want to die, and they're so happy about it.
And that's really everything you need to know about the Mountain Goats right there in a sentence.
All right. Shall we go on to the David Bowie?
Let's move on to the David Bowie.
All right, so this song is called Boys Keep Swingin', and let's take a listen.
Once more, find a copy of the song and pause the podcast now. So that was Boys Keep Swinging by David Bowie.
Rest in peace, by the way.
What's that?
Rest in peace to David Bowie. We haven't recorded in a long time, but...
So tell me why you find this song so funny.
Well, you know, in a similar way to how... I actually think No Children and Boys Keep Swinging are very similar in a lot of ways. Mm. No Children is like kind of marinating in this like self-destructive marriage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like kind of the negative emotions one feels with that, and just kind of like taking them to their extremes, even beyond their logical extremes.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way, Boys Keep Swinging is just kind of marinating in male privilege. Right, especially this is in the 1980s,
79, I think.
Oh, 79. I apologize. He could see the 80s coming. Bowie was always a step ahead.
Yeah, no kidding.
But you know, it's like, and he comes out the gate. You know, talk about swinging. He comes out the gate swinging. He doesn't build up to. He doesn't start with the mundane and build up to these kind of. Gigantic exaggerations. He literally starts with the first two lines of the song, "Heaven loves ya, the clouds part for ya," right? Mm-hmm. So he's not starting with just like, you know, I'm a boy and like, you know, this is the things that happen. It's like literally like, no, this is like divinely ordained. The world is this structured for me,
mm-hmm.
that the clouds are actually parting for me, or at least I see the clouds as parting for me, right? That's
right.
My perspective on them. And the level of ridiculousness in this, I think makes it very clear that he's playing around, especially Bowie is someone who was always kind of playing around with gender, you know, particularly early in his career during like the glam phase.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's just, there's everything from the ultra mundane, which is almost more ridiculous when it's like, when you're a boy, you can wear a uniform. And that's very true, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's absurd also. It's like, wait, why do you just get to wear a uniform because you're a boy? What does that have to do with anything?
Right.
To these, you know, when you have this almost kind of like epic music happening behind them when he's saying, you know, the clouds are parting for you in this very kind of like... almost religious voice,
mm-hmm.
Of like revelation.
Yes. Sort of like Elvis, like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. And in that level, it seems to be doing what No Children's doing, which is kind of subverting the pop form, which mm-hmm. we were talking about, seems to be a very successful way for songs to be funny.
Yeah.
But what I think is really interesting about this song is it's really kind of a double subversion, right? Because it presents you with what seems to be this, you know, late 70s, early 80s synthy pop song. And then it's this exaggerated male privilege. But then on reflection, you realize that's not really a subversion at all, right?
Right.
That's exactly what pop music is about.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, in the rock idiom. I was in the grocery store the other day, and it's an old like 50s rock song playing over the speakers, and the chorus is "You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine." And this is a this guy's gotta be. I mean, I always think people sound older in those 50s recordings, but this guy sounded like he was like late 20s at the youngest,
right?
And you know, it's like super creepy, but that's what I think makes this song work. Mm-hmm. Is I don't know if it would be that interesting just to be like, oh, look, yeah, men have it a lot better, huh?
Right.
But the way that it's doing it, and sort of, I think what it's ultimately doing is not really revealing the presence of male privilege as much as it's revealing the presence of male privilege in pop music.
Hmm.
It's like kind of referring you back to examine the other pop music of the time, especially all those love songs where women are extreme objects.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what he's kind of doing is, giving you the rule book for all those other songs, right? Like, this is kind of why these songs are happening, because when you're a boy, you can just kind of do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to keep swinging regardless of whether anyone wants you or not. Like, that's what, right? He's not encouraging boys to keep swinging, right? He doesn't say, boys, you should keep swinging.
Sure.
Or he's just kind of observing a fact.
Right.
It's kind of like, I almost kind of read it like a boys will be boys sort of phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know how boys are. They just,
they're just going to keep
swinging that bat whether we want them to or not.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've talked a lot about this. What are your thoughts on the song, boys?
Yeah, I mean, like, that all makes perfect sense to me. It's definitely him talking about, like, how unreservedly great it is to be a boy, and he's bringing in so many things, like he's bringing in nationalism, where he says, you know, you mm-hmm. get to wear a uniform, and then he says, like, seemingly out of nowhere, uncage the colors, unfurl the flag. Like, well, what flag, you know?
Yeah.
The flag of your country, the one you're going to be marching for, you know?
Yeah.
And then he says, like, in that same verse, says, luck just kissed you hello. Well, like, man, aren't you lucky to be born in the USA or whatever, you know, whatever nationalism of choice is yours.
Yeah, I think probably we can read that as like the West,
right,
more generally,
mm-hmm.
like in a Cold War sense.
Yeah.
Whichever particular country.
Right.
And
then there's just this thing that seemingly only Bowie can do, which is to be like coded gay and super straight at the same time. I guess Bowie and Prince are kind of the only ones who ever get away with this. But when he says, you know, when you're a boy, other boys check you out, you get a girl, these are your favorite things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's what you want, is you want all the other boys to see you get the girl. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, it's this profoundly misogynist, like, you know, posture that men take so readily, that he's like, you know, taking the piss out of.
Yeah.
Because it's like, what you really care about is that the other boys are checking you out.
Yeah, exactly. The women are just kind of incidental objects mm-hmm. in all of this. I don't know, there's never an action taken by a female in this, right? There's a female is never like a subject of a sentence in this song or anything.
Not even close.
And I think very intentionally.
Yeah.
For a second, I at first thought the line "Luck just kissed you hello" was "Lucy just kissed you hello," which you know. But I think a very intentional choice on his part.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, interestingly, and I encourage everyone to check out the SNL performance of this song.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's,
if you can
incredible.
Find that whole, there's a whole, he did like two or three songs. I know he did TVC15, and Klaus Nomi is performing with him. And it's an amazing performance. And for Boys Keep Swinging, he has like this puppet body, which has a penis, which he flings out at one point, and the censors did not notice it. But you know what they did notice, Boris? What did
they notice?
the line, "Other boys check you out," which was muted.
Yep.
So, you know, you're on live television. This is such a perfect encapsulation of the song, right? You're on live television. You're spewing this misogynist crap, basically.
Yeah.
Into everyone's homes. You have a literal puppet dick that you're flinging about. And none of this is causing a problem. But, like, a vague allusion to some homoeroticism. It's like, oh, we got...
that's on the chopping block. That's
exactly. That's and that, in I think, really... is what Bowie's kind of trying to draw attention to, right? Mm-hmm. The most subtle, most coded...
reference actual, to, like, non-heteronormativity.
Yeah, but it's actually, like, you know, it's the closest thing to a real connection between people that happens in the song, right?
Right.
Sort of the unspoken attraction that's happening between these boys that cannot be recognized. Mm-hmm. Everything else that's happening is just all about the individual performing.
Right.
You know, there's no heart in any of these things. These are all, like, large groups of boys making collective actions. You know, I think he's very conscious, and I think he probably found it equally interesting that that was the line that...
yeah.
Is it NBC that does Saturday Night Live?
Yes.
That NBC decided to censor.
Right. Well, you know, you're saying about individualism... so there's this, one of the lines towards the end of the song is, "They'll never clone ya, you're always first on the line when you're a boy." Mm. And that's really, like, telling, you know, it's this, like, view, like, you are the, like, rugged individual, the cultural warrior who will defend, you know, like, your homestead or whatever.
Yeah.
And that... So he's, like, putting that in very explicitly.
Yeah, and that's ultimately, that's really what male privilege is, right? At the end here, with the never clone you line, we're getting it, what's really the essence of what's going on here, is it's not the little particular privileges, like clothes fit you more often and mm-hmm. stuff. It's easier to find, you know, products aimed for you.
Right.
What's really going on, that's the damaging thing, is that you get to be an individual.
Mm-hmm. And right, you're not, you're judged on your character, not on your class status,
mm-hmm.
not yeah. on your group status.
Yeah.
As a woman, and, as black, as gay.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because you get, like, you know, other people have said this, you know, being privileged ultimately is about getting to be generic, mm-hmm. right? And if you get to be generic, then every particularity that you do becomes part of your, like, individual essence.
Right.
Right. It's saying something about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not saying something about white men, mm-hmm. because white men are, like, culturally this blank canvas.
Right.
Essentially. And that's ultimately what privilege is about, and what I think he's exposing in this song, but exposing it in a very, you know, coy, and I think more effective way, because if he just came out there and sang a song saying this, like, pedantic stuff we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't be effective.
Right.
What do you think about the,
I think the sort of brazenness of, like, pointing out how great it is to be a boy in a society where, you know, it's meant to be unspoken that that's the case. Right. That's kind of what makes a song actually funny, is you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe he actually is just, like, saying this.
Yeah. But at the same time, let's not blow too much smoke up Bowie's butt, because the song itself is an example of white male privilege, right?
Sure.
Because he gets to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really necessarily alienate him from most people, because he gets to be the generic. People that don't want to hear that message just won't hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just hear, like, a grooving beat and, like, how great it is to be a boy.
Right.
But, and I don't know, you know, I'm not really interested in ascribing, like, blame on anybody in any of this, but that's, you know, that's definitely something that's going on here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is the song is enacting the very privilege that it
well, and I mean, it can't not, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's true. I don't know how he would escape that, for sure. But I just think it's something worth keeping in mind.
Right. Well, so I think in part the effectiveness of the song is that it's, you know, David Bowie singing it. Like, somebody else, so if a woman sang the song, right, it might just sound, like, angry. You know, it might sound, like, facetious. But Bowie can say all these things genuinely, you know, like, all of these things are true as far as he's concerned. Because he's a celebrity, he's a, you know, good-looking guy, he's, you know, incredibly popular and influential and all these things. So for him, all of these things are literally true. But for most people for whom these things are true, they never point that out, that this is why they're true, or at least in part why they're true. Whereas he's laying
He's,
And so yeah, kind of
he's
only
checking
someone
his privilege,
like
basically,
him.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which, I mean, apparently that's what we're supposed to be doing. So,
well,
good for him. And
again,
you know,
ahead of his time.
Yeah, and you know, and this is fairly late Bowie. Not late in like the grand scheme of things, but like he's a very established performer by now. This is the last album in the Berlin trilogy. You know, Ziggy Stardust has already been out for a long time. You know, he's already undergone several career transformations at this point, and he's established this reputation as this androgynous, chameleon performer. I think the chameleon thing with him sometimes gets a little overstated, because it's an easy interpretation. But nonetheless, you know, this is kind of how the public is viewing him, and it kind of puts him in a unique position to be able to talk about these issues in a more subtle way, where I don't think anyone's going to actually take it at face value, despite what I said earlier, because it's Bowie.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you can take Bowie at face value at anything. What do you think of it from like a musical perspective as to what's going on? Like with the instruments?
I mean, it's a fantastic little like dance song, you know. I'd love, like, I don't think I've ever heard it at a club, but you know, an 80s night or any, or you know, 70s, 80s night, but I'd love to dance to it. It's actually so, apparently, you know, if you read the Wikipedia page about it, it was made because Brian Eno pulled a card out of a like stack of suggestions and read reverse roles, and so the guitarist played the drums and the drummer played the bass, and that's how they wrote the song, which like makes it really interesting to me and isn't really connected in any way to the lyrics, which we've mostly been talking about.
It is in a way, right? Because he's definitely examining roles in these lyrics, right? I don't know if he's reversing them.
Right.
But he's at least taking a step to the side and looking at them. You're not going to have someone else sing on the Bowie record.
Like, right.
But at least not lead. What I also think is interesting about it musically is, you know, it starts as like, you know, fairly straight pop. It's very quirky, obviously, because it's Bowie. It kind of goes into, I think I can't remember his name. If you still have the Wikipedia page up, who's playing guitar in this? It's the guy from King Crimson, right?
Carlos Alomar.
Oh, okay. On Heroes, the guy from King Crimson is playing guitar. But, you know, it ends on a fade out of a fairly long instrumental section with this, like, bonkers guitar solo that's, like, it's sort of shifting in and out of tune.
Yeah.
It kind of turns into this, like, weird, like, Dr. Seuss steampunk thing. And I find that very interesting, you know, in sort of it. He's kind of, it almost sounds like it's coming out of a robot factory or something to me, this song. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like, it's very constructed, the way, like, you know, this kind of pop music is.
Right.
But it's like, there's something off, like, there was something wrong with the factory workers that day, and, like, just the pieces aren't on quite right, and it, it's almost like a pop abomination in a way, because it's like it looks like a pop song, but then it's like telling you to kill it at the end. It's like, please kill me, please kill me. That to me is kind of what that guitar solo is doing. Which again to me kind of, you know, it all kind of plays into what makes the song funny, or at least amusing, is it's presenting us with what is seemingly what we expect out of pop music.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, something's off, but it's also making us realize what's the truth of what pop music is.
Was this just this, like, unnatural abomination?
Yeah, and I mean, what is pop music if not an unnatural abomination, right? It's definitely not natural. at least this kind of pop.
Mm-hmm.
All right, any parting thoughts, or shall we move on to recommendations?
No, I mean, well, so there's a few things I want to say. I found it really interesting that, how actually, coincidentally, almost, both these songs are very structurally similar. They both, you know, start right in on the subject matter. They have, like, a couple short little bits of chorus, no real chorus. And then they end out on a long, like, instrumental bit, which just kind of lets
that's,
you, like,
yeah, that's very true,
like,
yeah,
ruminate on what the hell you just heard, and kind of process it. Now, obviously, Boys Keep Swinging is much more musically complex than No Children, because almost every Mountain Goats, like, song is just, like, three or four chords on a acoustic guitar, even when there's, like, other instruments, like there was the piano and No Children and stuff. You know, the heart is always just a simple chord structure. Mm-hmm. As compared to, you know, Bowie's records, which are, like, so produced and so, you know, often melodically complex, in ways that I'd, like, almost don't always like. You know, you and me have talked about this before, where, like, often listening to David Bowie's music doesn't do much for me, and I don't know, like, what it is exactly about it, if it's his voice or his production style or his writing style, I don't know, but, like, it's impossible to say that David, like, whether it appeals to you immediately on an aesthetic level or not, it's impossible to say that David Bowie's music is anything but brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as we've said, like, several times already, ahead of its time and, like, incredibly influential.
Oh yeah, you can hear so many songs in this song.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's, like, a little, at some point, there's, like, a little, like, kind of background vocal that you hear, mm-hmm, that I'm pretty sure was extrapolated out into, like, of Montreal's entire discography. Like, they were just like, that.
Yeah.
let's take that. But, like, you know, so many, so much of, like, modern indie pop, mm-hmm, and, you know, that's the more obvious, route, but,
right,
you know, just so much of modern, like, alternative has descended from all the directions he's gone in.
Yeah.
For sure. Although perhaps not lyrically as much as we would like sometimes.
Indeed. I think that that covers pretty much everything we have to say about these two songs. Do you have anything to wrap up with, Devin?
Well, you know, if there's anything, we seem to have determined the perfect comedy song formula, which is, you know, come right out the gate, have a little chorus, and then end on an instrumental fade out. That's just the way you make a funny song.
Yeah, I think that should work.
Yeah, just as long as you just need to give people time to think about how funny the song was at the end. But anyway, we always like to give a couple recommendations at the end of the episode of just really no criteria whatsoever. It doesn't have anything to do with what we were talking about. Just something we've been listening to lately, or even something we haven't been listening to that we just want to bring people's attention to. And we're not trying to get points for obscurity here or anything either. Boris, what's your recommendation for the week?
So I've been lately on a loop listening to the MF Doom album, Food. which is actually full of songs that, while not comedy songs, are often really funny, so it does kind of fit the theme. I got into MF Doom through his album The Mouse and the Mask, which he did with Danger Mouse, which is all about...
One of my favorite records.
It's amazing. It's all about Adventure Time... Adult Swim cartoons.
Adult Swim.
Yeah, like Aqua Teen Hunger Force and Sea Lab and stuff. And features a lot of the voice actors, some of those shows on the album. That's a great album too, but my actual recommendation is an album he made before that called Food that actually brought him a ton of attention. And if you want a really, really good time, go on YouTube and look up a video of Mos Def geeking out about how much he loves MF Doom. It is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. What's your recommendation, Devin?
MF Doom, fantastic rapper. Possibly my favorite. So for my recommendation, I've been, I was watching Stranger Things, as I'm sure many people were, which has just kind of put me in this world where all I want to listen to is 80s synth stuff. So I've been listening to, obviously, to the Stranger Things soundtrack a lot and to the band Survive that did that music. Mm-hmm. But my specific recommendation is called, it's by this, I don't know if it's a group or it's like a label or something. It's called Retro Promenade. And you can find this on Bandcamp at retropromenade.bandcamp.com. It seems like they do all these sort of like 80s inspired compilation records. And they actually did three volumes of a Twin Peaks tribute. And I think the first volume is the best one. It's called The Next Peak Volume 1. And it's basically kind of like taking the music from the show Twin Peaks and reimagining it like it's the soundtrack to Blade Runner or like to Miami Vice or something. Like the cover's got that great like neon font and everything. Like it reminds me of like the credits to Drive or something.
Sure.
And it's just great fun, especially if you're a Twin Peaks fan. And I'm drinking out of a Twin Peaks coffee mug as we speak. And it's just great, I think great working music too, because it's just like you can just kind of marinate in this, and it's not the kind of music we would really ever talk on here about because we don't have the lyrics as a crutch, but, it's a great listen. So that's my recommendation.
Coming up next, the all-instrumental episode of Best Band Ever.
We just sit around stroking our chins and going, yes. All right. Thanks a lot, everybody.
All right. Have a good night.
Theme music.